I had planned to talk to a little bit about how the weather was starting to warm up outside, and you know, and we had talked about finally getting out and doing some gardening, and I'm sure some of you are getting tired of this long, cold winter. The winter has not definitely been cooperating the last few weeks. It's funny how the weather forecast for the last 2 weeks have almost been identical. They said, well, we're expecting the weather to clear up any day now, and it's going to start to a warming trend. And every day they said the same exact forecast. And you think, okay, another day of rain, another day of rain, three more days of rain. And so it's gotten pretty old. But weather's been in the news quite a bit lately. Anyone watching the news in the last few weeks could not have missed all the coverage of recent disasters around the world. On May 12, 2008, five newlywed couples arrived at a deserted, century-old French Catholic monastery to take wedding pictures in China's Sichuan province. Moments later, a 7.9 magnitude earthquake shook the monastery as well as all the rest of central China. These are actual pictures taken by a photographer that was there to take the pictures on that day, and these are pictures of the monastery coming apart as the earthquake happens. The group escaped serious injury because they were outside when the quake hit. They were left in total dismay as buildings collapsed. The air was thick with dust, rubble was everywhere, and as the guests tried to make sense of it all, they looked back at what was once a very picturesque scene. The old monastery was destroyed, as much as the rest of this part of China. But unlike the rest of China, these buildings were unoccupied. Elsewhere, tens of thousands were trapped in collapsing structures as Chinese officials tried to bring order to the chaos. The death toll was climbing day by day. These people were fortunate. Their lives were spared. But thousands of others were not. As it stands today, 68,000 are confirmed dead. 22,000 are missing, probably buried. 5.5 million people are homeless. And in the news even today is landslides caused by the earthquake has blocked many of the rivers in the area. And as they blocked the rivers, it created lakes. And those lakes are filling and building. And there are towns downriver. And there are hundreds of thousands of people in different towns that are at risk. And they have been evacuating people for the last week and a half in case these things break loose and completely destroy the towns that haven't been destroyed by the earthquake. You know, 10 days before the China quake, Cyclone Nargis stormed into Burma, destroying most of the coastal villages. You probably remember hearing about this. As you look at the map here, all the areas that are red are the areas that were directly flooded and, for the most part, destroyed. All of the coastal villages along that delta are pretty much wiped out. The lighter area that you're looking at up here was also heavily affected by the cyclone. It's not until you get farther up into Burma before they escape serious damage. Adding insult to injury, the Burmese military leadership has delayed rescue workers from other nations from being able to help the worst hit areas. There are people along the Delta area that still have not had any relief after almost a month now, and there's real danger of starvation for some of these people. Right now we know of 78,000 dead, 56,000 missing. That number is definitely going to go up, even probably from the 56,000 missing, because they don't have accurate census reports for some of these really remote villages. It'll take maybe even a year for them to really know what the death toll is. As I said, 2.5 million people around Burma was affected by this, and right now there's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of about a million people that are in danger of starving to death because they can't get fresh water, they can't get food. Some of these areas are so remote that they've gotten very little relief up till now. But what about disasters close to home? Certainly the news in the last few weeks and months have had quite a bit to talk about. Here's a story I pulled off the web talking about recent tornadoes that have struck the United States. And I highlighted two areas here to read. And as it talks about how many were killed and what towns it was affecting, it says, although And though spring is typically only the start of tornado season, this is just the latest spat of killer tornadoes in the United States this year. Already the death toll from tornadoes is 98 people, nearly 60% above the average over the last 3 years. The U.S. has already been hit by 71% of the tornadoes expected in a typical year when compared to a 10-year average. The year is only 34% through, and we're only just entering the typical tornado season. Here is a chart that the government puts out, and it tracks the 10-year trend. And this area of the yellow area here is what a 10-year track has been for average tornadoes. And if you look at 2005, 2005 actually hit the average as expected. 2006 and 2007 were actually a little bit less than a typical year. But this year, as evidenced by the red line, is growing at a much faster rate than what we would expect in a 10-year trend. Another type of disaster that we look at each year is the hurricanes that hit our country. This is the annual forecast that comes out each year as they try to predict what we are probably going to see this year. And as we see, there's only a 10% chance that this will be a below normal year. We've had two below normal years in a row, and this year is promising to be above normal, 65% probability that an above normal season will occur this year. For 2008, the outlook indicates that there'll be a 65% chance that 12 to 16 named storms, including 6 to 9 hurricanes and 2 to 5 major hurricanes of categories 3, 4, or 5. In average season, we would have 11 named storms, including up to 6 hurricanes, and 2 of them might become major. So if we do have 5 major hurricanes as a possibility, that would be a significant increase over the norm. So what are we to make of all this? Scientists have argued about this. Some have come out and called it global warming. Many of you remember that after Hurricane Katrina, a lot of scientists came out and said, well, this is global warming at work. We're going to see this more and more each year. Other scientists came out and said, well, this is just a 10-year tract where we would expect to see more hurricanes for about 10 years, and then it'll start declining. And so they would argue back and forth. What's interesting is after 2005, we had two below normal years. And where did all the scientists go? They got very quiet on the topic of hurricanes being caused by global warming. Looking at some stories that I pulled off the web, this is a snippet from the journal Nature. This came out in 2005, right around the time of the controversy when it was just starting to heat up. And it says, latest analysis suggests global warming will increase intensity of storms. And then we had 2 years of quieter conditions. And I pulled this story out. I found this story referenced about 20 or 25 times in the last few months in different newspapers around the United States. Global warming reduces hurricanes, in the U.S. report says. So it's interesting when you watch scientists argue over this. I remember, if you remember, there was a debate in around the year 2000. It was heating up over the whole Big Bang theory again. And even though that theory's been around for a long time, it got back in the news because they had this contest out there for scientists who could prove it one way or the other that the Big Bang Theory was a legitimate phenomenon. And a group of scientists using radio telescopes were able to measure the speed in which the galaxies were moving apart from one another while studying, I believe, quasars or quarks or something. And in doing so, they were astonished to find out that the galaxies are not slowing down the way the Big Bang Theory would have us believe, in that gravity would be pulling on these bodies in space, and over time that will slowly slow these things down, and that over millions of years the entire universe will all implode upon itself once again and have another Big Bang. But they found that instead of the universe actually slowing down, it is speeding up. and they could not come up with any reason for that. And from about 1999 to about 2001, 2002, there was very little talked about. And then all of a sudden, I watched a program on either the Learning Channel or one of those Discovery channels. And science says, we figured it all out. There's this substance in the universe that you can't see. You can't measure. You can't know that it exists outside of the fact that we know it's there. And it's called dark matter. And see, what happens is dark matter just starts to form in the space between all the bodies in space. And as it forms, it pushes these bodies apart. Now, if we could measure dark matter, we could prove this. But you see, science would rather believe on something that they cannot prove rather than something that they can't prove, which is God. And it is interesting how science, sometimes at the drop of a hat, will completely change course. And they never look for the real truth, do they? Just like this here. They don't look for what the real cause is. Having a fierce debate in the hurricane discussion and then having it go away and then come back in a reverse course, people should take note of that. Here is a story that NBC News put out around 2005, and I think this kind of sums up sort of the kind of hype and concern that was going on at the time. And I'll read part of it here. It's been 10 months of epic disaster. First, there was a tsunami that killed some 250,000 people in Southeast Asia. Then came Hurricane Katrina with its devastating toll on the Gulf Coast, followed by an earthquake that took tens of thousands of lives in South Asia. Now, Hurricane William, one of the most powerful storms ever measured in the Atlantic Basin. Wait a minute, I thought global warming was supposed to stop the intensity of storms, but here the most powerful storm ever measured in the Atlantic Basin is stalking the Florida coast, and experts are warning of a deadly avian flu pandemic. It's enough to make just about anyone pause to look for the meaning in the madness. For many who await Judgment Day, the writing is on the wall. So here NBC News is doing a story 3 years ago because there was so much going on that too many people were talking about this. Is this a biblical event? Is this something going on? Is there something more than just what science has led us to believe? I remember at work, people who were probably the least religious people I would know would come up to me and say, what do you think about all this? Is this really something? But you know, that was a few years ago. And then the pandemic didn't happen, did it? The avian flu. We're still waiting. There was not any other horrible things going on here that would lead credence to this thinking. So pretty much everyone just forgot about it. The world went back to worrying about things like gas prices, who's going to be in political office, and the headlines returned to normal. But it was interesting to see this topic start to make its way in the national media. So what does the Bible say? What are the signs that the Bible reveals as evidence of the last days? You know, one of the scriptures that people go to more than just about any others is in Matthew 24. And it says, Matthew 24 in verse 3, "Now, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming? And at the end of this age.'" Now, Jesus had just been talking about the coming destruction of the temple and some of the hard times that are coming ahead. And the disciples are really concerned about this, and they certainly wanted to know. And Jesus answered and said unto them, "Take heed that no one deceives you." See, one of the things here is Jesus knew that the temple would be destroyed in their lifetime. Jesus knew that he was not going to return in their lifetime. But he gave them an answer to answer all of the questions that they had. "For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things shall come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All of these are the beginning of sorrows." So, when we look at this, we think of when we think of the wars, there's been so many since the time that Jesus said this. When he was saying there's wars in various places, sometimes we think about only in our recent past. But, you know, we've got to look at 2,000 years of wars in various places. And this is talking about a span of time between then and the end time. But then we see here that there will be famines, pestilence, and earthquakes in various places. All these things are the beginnings of sorrows. So we can take a lot from that. And when we see the disasters happening around the world, it certainly does key our mind into thinking that there are possibilities happening all around us. There is a database that is in Brussels, and this is done at a university there. The European Union uses it to collect data on worldwide tragedies and whatnot. The U.S. government, as well as British government and other world nations, use this database to track and record the frequency and intensity of disasters around the world. And I pulled this chart from their database here. And this is showing the natural disasters reported from the last 107 years. And what you see here is a steep increase in number of disasters around the world. And it is really stark when you look at 100 years. Because, you know, people will tell you, oh, you know, we've had earthquakes, we've had this, we've had that. But it is interesting when you look at a pattern develop, and this is really hard data to refute, that there is a significant increase in the number of disasters over the last 100 years. You know, Mark 13 and verse 8 says, "For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places." This is a parallel to what we read in Matthew. But it says here, "There will be famines, but this is but the beginning of the birth pangs." And you know, I really started thinking about that term, birth pangs, because when you look at what happened in 2004 and 2005 as being a very busy time for some of the disasters, and then things got quiet again. And different parts of the country, or different parts of the world, rather, will have some events that happened in 2005 and 2006, but we didn't. And when we were suffering, those parts of the world weren't suffering. So it does come in waves, almost like birth pangs. In this other chart here, we look at estimated damage in financial damage reported from these disasters. And you see, from about 1970 on is where we get some real expensive damage. The one thing that was really clear in all this data is that the disasters now are affecting more people than they did long ago, mostly because the population has gone up. The more people you have, more people you have living in coastal areas, the more people that are going to be affected when there are disasters in that area. And you see these spikes that happen every couple years, and it just seemed to emulate what Mark was talking about as birth pangs. Here's another chart here, and this is breaking down the same time frame, but breaking it up by the types of disasters that we've seen. Now, the first group on top there, hydrometeorological, these are things like the hurricanes, the cyclones, tornadoes, floods, and even drought is covered by that. And you can see the sharpest increase we've had in disasters are in this area. Mark talks about famines and pestilence, and that would be falling largely also under biological, where different types of epidemics and pandemics, HIV, there's a lot of malaria killing people in Africa as well as HIV. And Africa really is suffering in this area almost more than anybody else on Earth. It is really stark when you look at how some of these different types of disasters are affecting different regions of the world differently. And the last one, which probably has the least amount of growth compared to the other two, is geological. And certainly Mark and Matthew both talked about earthquakes increasing. And we are not seeing the type of increase in earthquakes that equal the increase that we're seeing in the other disasters. What are we supposed to see? I don't know. I did zoom in on this part of the last 30 years of the earthquakes here in the next chart here. And this is looking, just zooming in on the earthquakes, the total quakes shown for this year, for each year. These are total quakes of a certain magnitude, like 5.0 or higher. What's interesting is when you look at all of the earthquakes to any magnitude, the number is somewhat steady as far as what we see from year to year. But of the size and intensity of the earthquakes, that has definitely been growing. Now, this, which I'm not sure if you can see, it looks like it's cut off. It does. The chart actually does go to 2008, and it does include the time frame that the China earthquake happened. And even with that figured in, we see a significant drop-off from about 2005 till now. And they are coming in waves, and there is a slow and steady climb in the numbers that we are seeing. When we break it down versus the types of earthquakes, even or types of disasters even further, we see even more patterns develop. Here we see the time frame goes linearly from top to bottom. And so you have 1900 at the top and modern times at the bottom. And you can see that the number of natural disasters are all increasing across the scale, with the probably exception of epidemics. But it is important to notice that we would expect things like earthquakes, famines, and pestilence, as described in the Gospels, to probably be a little stronger than what we're seeing. Earthquakes are starting to increase, as you can see here, but by nowhere near the level that we're seeing in windstorms, that we're seeing in China. We're seeing in the Asia region, as well as even in North and Central America. Volcanoes, something we haven't talked about, is growing in number of volcanoes reported, and I think we've remembered a number of them in the news in the recent months. But droughts and famines, although they are definitely starting to pick up, by comparison, they are not as high as some of the other indicators. Another thing that's interesting to look at is death toll. This is looking at the death toll from natural disasters over the last 100 years. Now, when we looked at that first chart, we saw very little reported damage effect from disasters from 1900 to about 1940. Yet, just because they weren't reported as heavily doesn't mean that the damage they caused was not severe. More people died in natural disasters before 1950 than after 1950. It is interesting to see that the pattern of increase in disasters is not mirroring the increase in death toll from natural disasters. We are seeing, of course, this is, you picture Asia, the tsunami, those kinds of things. This probably right, this spike right here is probably the tsunami that killed 250,000 people. And you can compare that to some of these bigger events that killed far more people. Because once upon a time, a 4.0 earthquake would have caused way more damage than it would today. And likewise, flooding and whatnot, there was not early warning systems, there was not the medicine that's out there. And so disasters used to kill way more people than they do today. You know, we look at this chart here, and this breaks down the it further by types. And what we see is, again, the different, these are the number of people reported killed, and it's still, beginning of the century, more devastation than at the end of the century. So we go back to this chart. It is very impressive. What we don't know was how many disasters went unreported. What we don't know was how many people from this chart, how many people in this area, when this little spike happened, how many people did that kill? See, we think about it, oh, that's nothing because it's so small. But that could have killed way more people than something over here. And so that sometimes the data doesn't seem to fit what we believe we would expect for this type of thing. And, you know, I started thinking, this looks like a very high peak. This seems significant. But what we don't know is when the Great Tribulation starts, how high will this go before the Great Tribulation gets fully underway? I mean, I just sort of projected out, what if things were to go on quite a bit further? I mean, here's 2010. What if things went out to 2030? How high would this go? We see a small increase in the slope here from the 1970s onward. Are we going to see another sharper spike before the Great Tribulation comes? See, if we draw this on a much bigger scale, even though this is definitely significant, we don't exactly know what it's going to mean. Because once upon a time, when they had a disaster, it was on a scale that we could hardly imagine. Here, the Black Plague that worked its way through Europe in the 1400s killed between 75 and 100 million people. Can you imagine that? In fact, when I looked at the Black Plague over a 300-year period, it killed an estimated 300 million people. That's the population of the United States right there. So we are not seeing pestilence on that scale. What is going on in Africa is truly a tragedy. The lifespan there is about half of what our lifespan is. If you make it to your 40s, you're probably considered an old man. The disease that they have there is rampant. The malaria, AIDS, malnutrition, so many things that go on there. But the rest of the country, the rest of the world, is not seeing those types of statistics. So here, as we look at this correlation of death toll dropping as the number of disasters climb as to the number of people affected, it's kind of stark. We would expect that during the tribulation, all of these trends would be going in the same direction. As we read, as many as a third of the Earth's population will be wiped out by pestilence. That is a much bigger number than 300 million people. That would be a number somewhere around 2 billion people during the Great Tribulation. The point I'm trying to make here is that what we're seeing are some definite trends, you know, and they're exciting. They really are. I think about when I was looking at some of those, I really didn't think I would see some of those charts spike up the way they did. Because I've heard people, I'm sure some of you have as well, oh, it's no different than what we've always had. You know, and I certainly, even in 2005, when the hurricanes were hitting and Katrina and the tsunami and all of those things were going on, there were people in my office that were saying, you know, every time something bad happens, everyone starts pulling their Bible out. He says, we've had this stuff from time immemorial, and this is not going to be any different. So there are people that believe that. But when I could see the data showing that, wait a minute, this is new, this is exciting, this is proof that things are starting to happen. If you look at 100 years and you look at the difference of things that are going on now to the things that were going on 100 years ago, it is really stark. But, you know, before Mr. Armstrong died, we were convinced Christ's return was imminent, weren't we? I was. I certainly remember those times. I call this next section 1984 in Prophecy. You know, you might remember the book the church put out years ago, 1975 in Prophecy. It was written in 1956. And they had about 20 years or so to believe that things were going to happen in a certain time frame. They thought they had some cycles figured out, and things were starting to come together in such a way. But as 1975 approached, it was pretty clear that it was not going to be the end time. Even with events like the Six-Day War in Israel, where you saw God's hand coming in there and intervening, and as exciting as that time would have been, as 1975 approached, it wasn't the year that they thought it was going to be. You know, for me, I came into the church, my family did, in 1975. So most of that stuff was before my time. I didn't reach that level of fever about prophecy until about 9 years later. And so that's why I call this section 1984 in Prophecy. when I look back at 1984, I remember of a number of events in my life that to this day I think back on, and it has affected me. You know, I've been speaking here a couple years, and I've never given a prophecy sermon at all. And part of the reason why is because my own experiences from those times as I was becoming an adult, and I had certain beliefs and certain expectations, and as those expectations did not happen, it shaped the way I think, and it has made me a different person today as a result. You know, growing up in the church, I was told I probably would not reach adulthood. Anybody remember hearing that? You probably won't reach adulthood before Christ returns. But in 1984, I graduated high school. And I said, well, I guess that one's not going to happen. In 1984, I went to see Mr. Armstrong speak in Vancouver. I don't know if any of you went to see him that year. They rented a giant arena in Vancouver, Washington. And I don't remember how many thousands of people were there, but there was a lot from the Northwest. And this was just a couple years before he died, and he was getting very tired. His eyesight was about gone. And he was saying he did not believe that we even had five more years before Christ would return. Of course, he felt that he would live to see Christ return, as we all did. But, you know, when we look back on that time, I remember hearing sermons all the time in church about how the gospel of the kingdom had been preached, that Europe was forming, and the earth was about to commit itself to total war. Do you remember some of those sermons? I remember hearing the debate over how much prophecy should we have in sermons. And I remember one minister saying, well, a third of the Bible is prophecy, so a third of the sermons on prophecy wouldn't be a bad deal. I don't know if you ever remember hearing that statistic. But we got a lot of prophecy in those days, and we were pretty excited. A lot of us were on our edge of our seats waiting for what we believe was imminent. What we wished we knew in 1984, there's a lot of them. I just picked a handful because as I look back and we have hindsight, sometimes we don't take the hindsight like we should when we look back and really try to learn from our mistakes. In 1984, the flag for Europe wasn't established yet. They didn't have a flag. That wouldn't be until 1986. We didn't know Europe's name. We used the term United States of Europe. I found that term in that book, 1975 in Prophecy. But it was a term that was descriptive and it made sense. The world at the time knew Europe as the EEC, the European Economic Community. And it was a trading bloc more than it was a sovereign country. The name European Union was not used until the European Treaty of 1993. Of course, all of us remember the Berlin Wall falling in 1988 or 89, a big event. Germany reunites. And it happened so quickly. And I remember thinking at the time, wait a minute, they said 5 years, it's 1988, 89. That's kind of in that time frame. Things could really happen. And I found myself kind of going down that road again, going, hey, maybe this is really going to be quick again. The European national currencies were replaced in 2002 with the euro. Now we see the euro competing against the U.S. dollar. And the U.S. dollar's value is dropping to an unheard-of level of value. You know, there was an article by Melvin Rhodes a while back talking about the dollar and what could happen to it if it was devalued to a point where it lost its credit rating. And I wasn't sure what they meant by it, but he goes on to say that global currencies are given a credit rating. If you have, I think it's an A1 credit rating, it can be used as what they call hard currency. And hard currency can be used all around the world. And currencies like that now are the euro, the Japanese yen, the British pound, and, of course, the U.S. dollar, which is all the global currencies are based upon. But if we lose our A1 credit rating, our dollar becomes what's called a soft currency. And a soft currency is not something you can go and buy things on the world market with. when African countries want to buy oil, they have to go and trade some of their goods and trade them for either dollars or euros. And when they do that, then they can use the euros to buy oil. Can you imagine what would happen to this country if the U.S. dollar became a soft currency? Hasn't happened yet. The Lisbon Treaty, this is probably the most recent news in Europe. The Lisbon Treaty is essentially a constitution. In fact, when you look at some of the stories on it around the world, they basically say it's a constitution that just happens to be called a treaty because the name constitution scared a lot of the member nations. There's now 27 member nations of the European Union. In 1984, there were 10. 10 was a very significant number to us in 1984. Now, Mr. Rhodes talks about, we don't know what's going to happen to get us from the 27 to the 10. We just don't know. We thought in 1984 that we knew a whole lot more about what was going to happen in Europe than we know about it today. The Lisbon Treaty doesn't take effect until 2009. Can you imagine if you could have heard a sermon in 1984 that said, oh, by the way, in 25 years from now, Europe will just sort of almost be a solidified country. But they won't have a national army yet. They will not have much of a foreign policy. Europe is a powerhouse today. I don't think they realize quite how powerful they are yet. And 25 years after 1984, who would have believed it would have taken this long to reach this point? You know, we focus more on the doomsday clock in 1984 than we did on preparing to be the bride of Christ. I don't know how many remember the doomsday clock. You remember hearing them talk about it back in the 80s? I have a picture of it here. And this is a chart here of the doomsday clock as it is today. The 60-year-old clock, based at the University of Chicago and maintained by the magazine's Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, serves as a monitor on the possible use of nuclear weapons and nuclear war. Midnight represents global catastrophe. This is the fourth time since the end of the Cold War that the clock has ticked forward. In the height of the Cold War, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the clock got to be 2 minutes before midnight. Then things settled down, and the clock got pushed back. The next time it peaked was 1984, and it peaked at 3 minutes before midnight. And I remember we talked quite a bit about it in the church at that time. Now, the reason it was 3 minutes before midnight was because of the conflict, the Cold War conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union and the arms race. And we knew in the church that the Great Tribulation would not be a battle between the United States and the Soviet Union. But yet we used the doomsday clock because it seemed to suit our purpose. Boy, look how close it is. Here's just another sign that it's going to happen, when really it was measuring something completely different than what we were using it to say. Well, in 1993, it was pushed back to 17 minutes before midnight, again, 7 years later. So right now, it's been climbing again. This article here talks about how they pushed it forward 2 more minutes because of climate change. And so now climate change is something they're scared about. Before this, they had pushed it forward because of terrorism that exists around the world. And currently, if you're interested, it stands at 5 minutes before midnight. So in 1984, many of the scriptural signs were just that, scriptural. We talked about it. Well, these are just metaphors. We're not going to really see these things, you know, visually, because, you know, you just have to understand that that's the way the Bible writes things. Today, we don't have to look very hard to see the signs of end time fulfillment of prophecy. Here, we see the Greek version of the 2-year-old coin. It's a little blurry here on this when it's blown up here. But basically on the left here, you see an image of a woman riding a beast right on the coin. The story of how Europe got its name is told by this coin, as it depicts Greek mythology, in which the goddess Europa, which is the woman, is seduced by Zeus in the form of a bull that rides her off to the island of Crete. The use of this symbolism to us is unmistakable, but to them, it's just merely mythology. you know, it's interesting how they see that this is just mythology. This isn't something that means anything biblically. I mean, this is just simply an image of a nation that is being led by a false god. That's all it is, because that's what Zeus was, is a false god. And we said, exactly, that's what it is. It's an image of a woman being led by a country being led by a false god. But the images don't stop here in their monetary system. These are some artwork and covers from Germany's Der Spiegel magazine. This is their largest news magazine. It's really the equivalent of our Time magazine here. And here we see an image very similar to what we read about in Revelation, as an image of a woman riding the beast. We might not realize how visible this symbolism is today, but it is out there, and it is everywhere in Europe. If you live there, you see it. I remember at the Feast Film this year, they interviewed some of the members who live in Europe, and they said, we see this stuff very clearly. And I remember thinking, okay, because they live there, I wonder what they see that I don't. It is interesting when you actually start looking at newspapers that are not American newspapers. Mr. Rhodes had another article talking about how, since he's been in the United States, he can't seem to get very good coverage of world events from United States news sources, whether it be TV, whether they be print news. It doesn't matter, because when you turn on the news, what do you see? You see the presidential election. You see things that are important, like that are fighting over the budget, price of gas, things that are important to us. If there's a disaster, of course, they're going to cover that. But how much time do they spend talking about world affairs? I mean, just trying to get a story about what's going on in Burma or China. I mean, every couple days there'll be another update. If somebody can find a new angle on that story, they'll cover those two, because those are big. But look how much we covered Hurricane Katrina, when only around 1,000 people died. It was nothing but all the coverage, 24 hours a day, people on the scene. Here we have hundreds of thousands of people dying, and every other night we might get a small blurb. So I took Mr. Rhodes' advice, and I started looking at different newspapers. And on my computer at work, when I take a break at lunch, I'll generally look over some of these newspapers. And the three that I look at most, first of all, is a British newspaper, first of all, the Times Online. And it is really impressive, the world news coverage that they have. You can click on different regions of the world, and they have stories daily about what's going on in every corner of the planet. It's really informative. The second one I look at is the newspaper equivalent of this magazine here called The Spiegel. And this is German's probably version of the New York Times. And boy, to look at some of the artwork and some of the things and the imagery that goes on in Germany, and they don't think anything of it. I read a story recently how they were talking about how Germany is the third largest weapons exporter on the globe today. I had no idea. Because, you know, you hear stories about how Germany's military today really isn't up to snuff compared to a lot of the other big militaries. But their war machine is definitely working, because they are ahead of China, ahead of a lot of Iran, other weapons exporters. North Korea, we always hear about as exporting weapons. Germany is third behind the United States and the Soviet, or Russia now, as far as exporting military hardware. So, you know, when you read the newspaper from Germany's perspective, it's very interesting. Of course, all of the European and world newspapers I look at have sort of a negative slant on the U.S., but I don't read their newspaper to read about what's going on in the U.S. I read their newspaper to see what's going on in the world. The third newspaper I look at is the Jerusalem Post, because if you really want to know what it's going to be like when Jerusalem is surrounded, boy, to read the newspaper from Jerusalem. They have a whole section of their paper called The Iranian Threat. They see the world in a very different way than a lot of other people around the world, because they see their own annihilation just the way we look at it in prophecy. And they watch every possible aspect. So it is interesting when you can look at what's going on in the world today from a different perspective than we normally get. And I started to really understand when that feast film, when those people were in Europe, were saying, we see this happening. But the images are way more blatant than this. This here is a sculpture that is the rise of the final resurrection of the Roman Empire. Here is a poster. This really blew me away. This is a poster was made toward the promoting European unity. And it's modeled on Peter Bruegger's famous 16th century painting called The Tower of Babel. The poster shows the people of Europe rebuilding the tower that God destroyed in Genesis 11. It's remarkable how blatant the symbolism in Europe is. The Bible refers to them as Babylon the Great, and here they are rebuilding the Tower of Babel, and Europe is gladly participating in it. More so than just in pictures, this here is the European Union Parliament building that opened in 2000 in Strasbourg. It was modeled on that same painting that we just looked at, the Dutch artist Peter Bruegger's famous 16th century painting, The Tower of Babel. All of these images would have shown themselves in time. In 1984, we knew none of this was going to be so blatant. We could not foresee how the images that we see read about in Revelation were going to play themselves out in such a visible way. I mean, this is their parliament building, and it's modeled on the Tower of Babel. It is just amazing that what's going on. You know, we've heard from some of our friends from college that are no longer attending the church anymore. Some of them are quite bitter about religion. And over those last so many years since the church broke up, they have gotten pretty bitter about not only the church, but what we believed and the idea that there was, prophecy was going to happen the way we thought. I think they feel duped. They feel they've been led down this crazy path by a fanatical group. And some of them actually talked to us. One just very recently wrote how she was very anti anything church of any kind, not just our church, but, you know, just completely calls herself an atheist now. And she was in college with us, very, very committed, very nice person at the time. And, you know, I thought to myself, if only some of these people had enough oil in their lamps to last to see some of these images actually play out. We don't see them every day. Our news media wouldn't know anything to make of a building like this and its significance. Unless you know what to look for, you don't see what everyone else is seeing in Europe. That's why the people in Europe have this different perspective in the church, because they have this wholly different view of prophecy unfolding right before their eyes. So what should we have focused on in 1984? There are a number of things that had we focused on instead of what we did, things might have been quite a bit different for some people who ended up leaving. Many remember the stories of Mr. Armstrong talking about his concern that as much as half the church really didn't get it, that he wondered, you know, when they showed up at the feast every year, they were excited about the kingdom coming any moment. They got that part. But how much of what we were all about did they really understand? About changing who we are inside from and creating a new person from the inside out that God would use as a tool to put his government out to the entire world. You know, over the next decade, the church did see tribulation, but it wasn't the one they thought they were going to see. In the 1980s, we were living on the edge of anticipation. We did not realize at that point that the bridegroom was going to be delayed. We looked for every possible sign that it was imminent. You know, that decade would pass, and then another decade, and then even more time, and we would still be here. Some could not keep up with that level of heightened sensitivity, and they ended up burning out. What we need to focus on What we needed to focus on was preparing ourselves for the kingdom of God rather than preparing ourselves to leave for the kingdom of God. That was the element, the key element that was missing in a lot of people's lives. And even for myself, yeah, I stayed on as well as all of you here. But I wasn't focusing on this in 1984, in 1994. I started focusing on that after we came to United. I started seeing this plaque that says preparing a people. And I thought, you know, I don't think we've put enough emphasis into that in the past. Preaching the gospel, that was the big emphasis. Preparing a people, you know, to some extent, that's what we did in our free time. We need to focus on God's heart and character in our lives. Let this mind be in you that's in Christ Jesus. That is one of the hardest things to do, and that is to put out the old man with the holidays talk about putting out the lemon, becoming a new creation, and becoming a member of God's family, the whole good and faithful servant. This is what we are all about. This is what God wants us to. And, you know, I found an interesting time going through some of the parables and looking at some of them and how much message they have for the church. They're just, it's so much more so for the church than the world itself. Because, yeah, they talk about the return of Christ as it affects the whole world. But when you start looking at them from the perspective of this is given to the people of God first and foremost, it, just like Jesus said, I speak in parables. Why does he speak in parables? So that nobody understands what he says. That's what he said. I speak in parables so you don't know what I say. But you know what I'm saying because I'm going to tell you. And your mind will be opened and you will be able to understand what the parables mean. So I pulled out three parables here that Jesus gave about preparing for his return. And we won't read them. I'm just going to refer to them because these are parables we all know. We can pretty much tell the story ourselves. We don't need to go and read them word for word again. The first one is the parable of the faithful servant and the evil servant. You know the story. The master leaves, put his servants in charge, and while he's gone, he is delayed. And some of the servants he puts in charge work diligently, just as if the master was there, doing the work of the master, while other servants decide to get drunk, to beat the other servants, and to take what they can for themselves. The lesson here is when Christ returns, he better find us doing what he called us to do. So this is a parable, but it's speaking about us, the end time people of God. When he returns, he needs to find us doing what he called us to do. Second one, very, very popular, famous parable, the parable of the wise and foolish virgins. You know the story, they all go and wait for the bridegroom to arrive. And they all had oil in their lamps. And then the bridegroom was delayed. And then everybody slept. It's interesting, we used to talk about, oh, we don't want to be like the ones that didn't have enough oil. But we skipped over the part where it said everybody slept. Because it gets everybody down when you wait and you wait and you wait. But the lesson here is that we need the oil that's spoken about, which we know of is the Holy Spirit. We need to have enough of that oil to last us as long as it takes. And we don't know how long that delay is. We definitely see signs that we're getting closer, and it's exciting. But we don't know how long it's going to be. The last one is a parable of the talents. You know this story. Jesus gives so many talents to each of his servants, and he says, go forth and do what you can to use those talents that I gave you. When he comes back, some of them have multiplied those talents tenfold, some fivefold. And then he gets to the servant that did nothing but bury the talent in a handkerchief and put it away. And, of course, the master is very upset, isn't he? So the least you could have done is put it in the bank and I've got some interest. But he did nothing with what God gave him but bury it and just wait for Christ to return. And it's very clear what this means. We will be doomed if we sit on with what we have, our talents and our gifts, and we do nothing with them. We talked about a few sermons ago, and it's been a recurring theme in different sermons. I heard Mr. Kylo talking about it. Mr. Foster certainly talked about it last week when he says that we have to be preparing for what we are about to face in the world tomorrow. We are going to be leaders in the world tomorrow. What do we know about leading the world? What talents and abilities do we have? And sometimes, as I talked about in a sermon a few weeks ago, we don't know what talents and abilities we have. But we can definitely, prayerfully, seek them out and then start to develop them. So God says we all have talents. He's given all of us some, and he expects us to do something with them for the greater good. Keeping an eye on prophecy while keeping our heart on the kingdom of God. You know, there's nothing wrong with looking at prophecy. I get pretty excited by it myself. I'll spend a little bit of time every week looking at some of those newspapers, looking at some of those signs and some of those things, and I actually record some of the newspaper articles that I see, and I put them in a place on my computer because, who knows, maybe I'll use them at some point. But you can keep an eye on prophecy and on your own life, focus on the job at hand. Our focus has to be on transforming our lives into the image of God, preparing to be kings and priests of the world tomorrow. There's so much that we have to do. It's okay to look at prophecy. God tells us to do so. We don't want to be caught off guard. If we need prophecy to get fired up, though, this is where the rubber meets the road. If it's prophecy that gets us fired up and nothing else does, if you find yourself listening to sermons going, oh, man, when this is over, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. And you're not thinking to yourself, wow, this is exactly what I need. This is what I've been praying to God to help me overcome, and this sermon is actually, you know, an answered prayer. If you're not seeing it from those perspectives, then probably there's something wrong that you need to look at, because there's nothing wrong with having prophecy get us fired up. It certainly fires me up. But to need prophecy to keep fired up is dangerous, because you can't live on prophecy. Mr. Kylo said as much at this year's GCE. He said, prophecy is not spiritual food. It's like a sugar rush, and it gets us all excited, and there's nothing wrong with being excited. You know, it's like going to a party, and you get excited about the party, and it's fun, and it's nice, and it's meant to be that. But we're not supposed to live our lives that way. We're not supposed to go from day to day to day trying to get all excited again on this hope. What we need to be excited about is the life that we're growing in us, the growth that we see in us, the growth we see in others, and the fact that we are getting ever closer to being that creation that God wants us to be. Working those gifts and multiplying them for use when Christ returns. He will need every one of those gifts to help him administer the kingdom of God. You know, prophecy is meant to keep us focused on the job at hand somewhat and not to become a job in itself. You know, we'll tell our kids when they're doing a project, remember, as soon as you get done with that, we're going to go do something else. We're going to go do something really nice. We use those kinds of things as sort of check our mind and say, yep, I'm right where I need to be. But you don't sit there and just talk about, all we're going to do is going to do this. All we're going to do is do that. All we're going to do is do this. And you don't do the job at hand, because in the example of teaching your kids to clean their room, if all you do is tell them about all things you're going to do when they finish, but you never do anything else, they never have any time to clean their room. And so you never get there. You know, the job at hand is something that I think a lot of us, at least here, I know we talk about it. I see us in the back when we're fellowshipping. We all talk about this. This is really important stuff. Trying to overcome ourselves, trying to put off the old person. And we know that devoting too much time to trying to figure out exactly when Christ will return detracts us from our mission. You know, we started playing about our Father's business for the last so many months now, and I've really found it helps me to say, okay, wait a minute, I'm part of something bigger here. Yes, I'm trying to work on myself, but we are part of something much bigger. We have a mission to accomplish here. And About Our Father's Business doesn't spend a lot of time on prophecy, does it? But it definitely lives up to its name, because that's what all of us need to be doing, is focusing on being about our Father's business.